thank you for being here to bring your worship to God. As we as a church embody our theme for 2020, I'm seeing some pretty cool things on social media. One of our church members a couple of weeks ago posted this on Facebook in a way of reminding us to flip from seeing the bad to seeing the good. I think it's coming up on the screen here, where it begins with like early wake up. So, oh, I got to get up early. Well, look at it this way. Children to love. House to clean. House to clean. Look at it this way. Safe place to live. Dishes to wash. Oh, that means I've got food to eat. So we're about this process of recognizing the good, even during some of our least favorite things to do in life. And then I saw this next post, which really embodies the truth about gratitude. It's not happiness that brings us gratitude. It's gratitude that brings us happiness. It's not, well, if I had something to be happy about, then I'd give thanks. No, that's not how we're wired. It's gratitude, expressing thanksgiving to God, that actually comes before happiness. It releases those happy chemicals in our brain that God has wired us with when we embody a life of gratitude. So our theme reminds us to recognize the good. I don't know if you believe me or not, because any preacher can say in the Hebrew or in the Greek, but on the screen, you're going to see the actual Hebrew word for gratitude, and it literally means recognize the good. I'm not going to try to pronounce that Hebrew word for you, but if you want to Google it, there's your spelling. You can verify the truthfulness of it. But again, the word itself reminds us that before we can express gratitude, we got to recognize the good. It's recognizing the good. That's a good thing that should lead us to being grateful people. Now, there are two enemies of gratitude among many. One is working too much, and the other is having too much. If we work too much, we're liable to be too busy to recognize the good all around us. And if we have too much, we're liable to become desensitized to all of the good things that have been brought into our lives. I love what this French priest wrote years ago. The worst thing that could ever happen to us is if everything went right for us. I mean, if everything went right for us all of the time, we'd have a difficult time becoming grateful people. John Ortberg wrote this: sometimes we do not realize how much we have to be grateful for until it is threatened. It's only when water is taken away and threatened that we become sometimes grateful for a glass of water. I don't know about you, but for me, it's going to be pretty hard for me to ask the Lord to do something to slow me down so that I can become grateful. And it's going to be pretty hard for me to say, Lord, take away some of my blessings. Don't allow everything in my plans to go right this week so that I can become grateful. But regardless of whether we have the desire to pray those prayers, God, who is a gracious God, may simply do those two things for us in order to help us. And when he does, it will reveal what's already inside of us. Here's the thing about suffering and disappointment. Here's the thing about things not going right for us all of the time. For some people, suffering pushes us further from God. And for others, suffering pushes us closer to God. But regardless of how or when we're suffering, it's going to reveal what's already inside of us. And so this morning, as Jim has mentioned, I'm going to talk about how to recognize the good in the giver during the worst times in our lives. In week one of 2020, we talked about recognizing the good. Last week, we talked about recognizing the giver as well as the good. And now we're talking about how to do both during the worst days of our lives. So I'm bringing you to the book of Job. It's a book you know well, and you know that Job at the beginning of the book is given the worst news of his life. I'm not going to read it to you because you've read it many times before. I'm simply going to summarize the news that Job received. Here it is. Job, you've just lost your multi-million dollar business. It is all gone. And you've just lost all 10 of your children. They are all dead. Chapter 1, verse 20 and 21 records Job's response. At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Those are actions in ancient days of someone who is grieving. It tells us that Job is not a sociopath. He is feeling this bad news. He's recognizing that this is bad news, and it is grieving his soul. But the passage continues with these words. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." My question for Job is, how did you do that? Sometimes we do that in the rearview mirror of life after we've waded through depression and anxiety and suffering, but how did you do that on the front end of this worst news possible? It's the same question I asked a good friend of mine who revealed that years ago his son was stillborn. And when doctors brought the news to him, his immediate response in that hospital was to get on his knees and pray this prayer of Job's. The Lord gave, and the Lord takes away. May the name of the Lord be praised. How does someone do that? This morning, I'm going to explain to you through Job's own words how he was able to continue to recognize both the good and the giver after receiving the worst news possible in his life. Well, as you know, in chapter 1, Satan is having a conversation with God, and when you can sort of process through just that idea of Satan and God having a conversation, you realize that Satan believes that Job is only worshiping God for Job's own personal gain. And so Job, or rather Satan, asked God the question, does Job worship God for nothing? Again, Satan goes on to describe his theory that the only reason why Job worships God is because of what he's getting out of the deal. And so Satan says, you take away his blessings, make things go wrong instead of right for him, and he will no longer worship you. He will drop you, God, like a bag of rocks, and he'll go on his way and do his life without ever worshiping you again. So, in a sum, what Satan has just said to God is this. Job is in a transactional relationship with you, God, not a genuine relationship. So in case you don't know what a transactional relationship is or what it looks like, let me briefly describe it for you. In a transactional relationship, an exchange rate is developed in the market where one person does this and another person does that. And there's this constant steady stream of exchanges taking place, and that is the baseline of the relationship. There are many marriages, many parent-child, many friendship relationships, and many work relationships that are purely transactional in nature. For instance, you ask a friend for a favor, and your friend's response goes something like this. I'll do it because one day I will need something from you. What your friend has just told you is this. I'm not doing a favor for you. I'm doing a favor for myself by doing a favor for you. You just learned that you are in a transactional relationship. It's not to say that in relationships, an element of transaction is wrong. Parents of little ones that are trying to potty train their little ones, I'm all for, I'll give you a couple of M&Ms if you'll use the potty and do a transaction that way. And I'm all for in marriages where couples have honest conversations and they say something like, you know, like my wife and I did when we got married, I hate polishing furniture because I hate it when it gets on my hands. I don't like to smell it. And Donna says, I'll polish furniture. And I said, well, I'll vacuum because I'm really good at vacuuming. I was trained since. And so we made that kind of transaction. And there is an element of transaction in every relationship. But the problem is when transactions become the baseline for relationships. And that's when it looks like this. Well, you didn't do that, so I'm not going to do this. And it goes back and forth, back and forth. You don't have a marriage relationship. You have a transactional relationship. You don't have a genuine friendship. You have a transactional relationship. And we're often oblivious to this reality until it literally hits us over the head. A husband gets cancer, and the wife says, I can't deal with this, and she divorces him. A child becomes severely troubled, and the husband says, I cannot deal with this, and he divorces her, and he leaves the child. You've just been witness to a transactional relationship. You lose your well-paying job, or you gain a lot of weight, or something else significant changes in your life. You go through a divorce, and all the people you thought were your friends, they're like nowhere to be found. And you've just learned the hard way that you've been in a transactional relationship. And Satan believes that Job is in one with God. And both Job and God are going to discover, once Job loses all of his blessings, that they have been in a transactional relationship. God, however, believes that he is in a genuine, authentic relationship with Job. And when Job loses everything, Job will continue to worship God. My question is not about Job this morning. We already know his story. My question is about you and me and how we will respond when we receive the worst news possible. What makes it extra difficult to recognize both good and giver during our days of suffering are at least two things. Number one is simply being overwhelmed by bad things in our lives. I mean, sometimes it's not just one thing that hits us or two things. It is a number of things. And when we feel so overwhelmed by so many difficult and painful things, it makes it extra difficult for us to continue to worship God. My daughter, when she started driving at 16, I gave her my beautiful white 06 Toyota Camry that I loved and took great care of. My favorite car my whole lifetime. Never gave me a problem. And then she came home with the first ding on the door and the second ding and the third ding. It's all I could imagine was like in that high school parking lot, all those kids are playing bumper cars. I mean, it's just one, boom, boom, boom. And so finally many months passed and Diana walks in the house through the garage and said, did you see what happened? I was like, no, I don't look anymore. I just can't. And sometimes when we're overwhelmed with bad things happening to us, we feel like we just can't look at God anymore. It makes it extra hard to continue to worship him. So does feeling abandoned by God during our worst times. Now, God never abandons us, but I'm talking about how we feel when we're overwhelmed by bad things. We feel abandoned by God. You read your book of Psalms, and you will be in the company of a number of people who feel abandoned by God. But in those Psalms, all but two of them also include a word of hope. Even in Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? Get to the end of the chapter, and still the author has some hope in the redemption process of God. But Psalm 39 and Psalm 88 are the two exceptions to the rule. As these writers feel abandoned by God, they offer no glimpse of hope in God. In fact, the end of chapter 88 reads this way, God, you have taken my companions and loved ones far from me. The darkness is my closest friend. Did you hear what he just wrote? He just wrote, God, darkness is a better friend to me than you are right now. I get something from the darkness. I get absolutely nothing from you. That's how he feels as he experiences this abandonment from God. Again, I said at the onset, suffering pushes some people further from God. But I've heard stories of other Christians who say, I've never felt closer to God than I have during the worst days in my life. And so Job and his wife process suffering in a different way. In chapter 2, when Job is personally inflicted with an illness, covered all over his body with sores, and his looks resembling that of a mangled monster, his wife says to him, are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. You know, it's said behind every good man is a good woman. Well, sometimes behind every good man is a woman having a bad day. And this suffering has pushed her further from God. But Job says in response to his beloved wife these words, shall we accept good from God and not trouble too? Did you hear him? He just said it. I'm not in a transactional relationship with God. I'm not in a relationship that says, if God does this, I'll worship him, and if God doesn't do this, I won't. I worship God. And here's how he did it, if we pay close attention to what he said back in chapter 1. So the screen goes blank up there because I'm done with PowerPoint. And I want you to listen very closely with your ears and with your heart and with your soul. How did he do it in real time? Immediately in his response to suffering, the first thing he said was, naked I came into this world, and naked I will depart. Can you hear it? Job carries in his soul no sense of entitlement. He does not feel like he's entitled to any good thing in his life. He doesn't believe God owes him one blessing in his life. I came in this world empty-handed. I'll leave empty-handed. God owes me nothing. You're not going to hear this much in our culture because we live in an entitlement culture with this feeling that everybody owes me something. My parents owe me something. My kids owe me something. My government owes me something. The God I worship, he owes me some good stuff in my life. It is deeply embedded, not just in the worldly culture, but in the Christian culture as well, this feeling of entitlement. So I'm watching the news a few weeks ago, and the story is about car manufacturers of these big SUVs. And the problem is that they're very, very expensive. And the car manufacturers continue to raise the prices so that families can't afford them. And then I hear the words, car manufacturers are depriving the American family of the American dream because either they can't afford these cars or they have to now take out loans for 6 and 7 and 8 years to buy these cars. And when they buy these cars, many people cannot afford them to begin with. And so they're up to their elbows in debt. And it's the car manufacturer's fault of depriving families of the American dream. I'm thinking, where was it written that families are entitled to big SUVs? What kind of Kool-Aid have we been drinking to think that the car manufacturers owe us big SUVs at rock-bottom prices because it's the American dream? I've got to have one of those to be okay. No, my thinking was this: don't buy one. Or buy a used one that you can afford. But that doesn't wash well in an entitlement culture that says, I deserve everything I could possibly want. God owes it to me. The government owes it to me. And even car manufacturers owe it to me. And Job is like, no, nobody, no one owes me anything. I'm watching this old Western last weekend where Clint Eastwood's character is over the guy played by Gene Hackman that he's about to kill, and Hackman's character says, I don't deserve to die like this. And Eastwood says, deserves got nothing to do with it. And Job is saying, deserve has got nothing to do with it. Naked I came into this world, and naked I will depart. And if you and I can let go of these preconceived ideas that God and everybody else owes me something, when the worst news comes, we won't have to wrestle with, but I don't deserve this, and we'll be able to worship God. Number two, Job believed God was sovereign, and that God could do whatever he wanted to do, even if it made no sense to him. These were his words: the Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Those of us who know the story know that it was Satan's idea. Let's take away Job's blessings, but God still signed the check. And nothing that is happening in Job's life is happening without God's permissive approval. God can give and God can take away at his discretion, and he owes no one any explanation because he is God and we are man. And quite frankly, if God tried to explain many things to us, we'd be more confused then than when he began, because his ways are not our ways and his thoughts are not our thoughts. Scripture says in Romans 9:20, but who are you, O man, to talk back to God? Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, why did you make me like this? No, no, no. Job will never receive an explanation for why things are going south in his life. And you and I often will never receive an explanation for why things are happening the way they are. But if we understand the sovereignty of God, that God can do whatever he wants to do, whether I like it, whether I want it, or whether I understand it, we will then better be equipped to worship God when we receive the worst news possible, because this sovereign God is a good God, and we're convinced of that. And then finally, number three, Job says, may the name of the Lord be praised. You know what I hear people say, even Christians today? I need to take a break from worship. I'm going through a lot. I need to take a break from church and service. Job is going through so much. And he says, I'm never going to take a break from worshiping God. There's this quote from an old church father that goes like this: God only had one son on this earth without sin, but never has God had a son on this earth without suffering. Only one son was sinless, but even that one son suffered greatly to bring us to God. And if he, Jesus Christ, never takes a break from worship, and if Job never takes a break from worship, because God is always worthy of worship, may the church never take a break as well. And it's because of Jesus that we can recognize the good and the giver, even during the worst of times. Somebody like me may never get it right in real time at that moment, but hopefully at least in the rearview mirror of life, as we relive the bad and difficult and disappointing circumstances of our life, in the rearview mirror at least, we'll be able to say, "Ah, oh, God still did so much good through those difficult times that I was totally oblivious to." And because we believe that, we can say, "It is well with my soul." Let's stand and sing that song together. If we can help you in any way, come forward and tell me how as we sing.
When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll,